Welcome to the Herbs with Rosalie podcast, a show exploring how herbs heal as medicine, as food, and through nature connection. I'm your host, Rosalie de la Forêt. I'm an herbalist teacher and the best-selling author of the books Alchemy of Herbs and Wild Remedies. I created this podcast to share trusted herbal wisdom so that you can get the best results when relying on herbs for your health. I love offering up practical knowledge to help you dive deeper into the world of medicinal plants and seasonal living. My goal is that you'll walk away from each episode feeling inspired to start working with herbs in your everyday life. Each episode of the podcast is available on my Herbs with Rosalie YouTube channel, as well as your favorite podcast app. Transcripts and recipes for each episode can be found at herbswithrosaliepodcast.com. To get the latest news as well as fun bonuses, be sure to sign up for my weekly herbal newsletter. Okay, grab your cup of tea. Let's dive in. I'm thrilled to have David back on the show. Like his last episode, which featured nettles, this episode is absolutely packed with knowledge and wisdom from David's 55 years of experience. There were times when I wanted to grab a notebook during this interview, and this is one episode you may want to listen to twice or more. For those of you who don't already know him, David Winston is a distinguished herbalist and ethnobotanist with over 5 decades of expertise in Chinese Western, eclectic, and Southeastern herbal traditions. With 47 years of clinical practice, he serves as a trusted herbal consultant to healthcare professionals and researchers across the globe. As the founder and director of the Herbal Therapeutics Research Library and dean of David Winston Center for Herbal Studies, he spearheads a prestigious 2-year training program in clinical herbal medicine. Renowned for his captivating lectures, David is a sought-after speaker at medical schools, professional symposia, and herb conferences worldwide. He presides over Herbalist and Alchemist, Inc., a leading manufacturer renowned for blending the art and science of herbal traditions into its products. A prominent figure in the herbal community, David is a founding member of the American Herbalist Guild and contributes extensively to botanical literature. His publications include Sal Palmetto for Men and Women, Herbal Therapeutics, and Adaptogens, Herbs for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief. Recognized for his contributions, David has received prestigious awards, including the AHPA Herbal Insights Award and the Natural Products Association Clinicians Award. In 2019, he was honored with an honorary doctorate degree from the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, reflecting his profound impact on herbal medicine and education. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be with you again.
Me
I had
too.
Such a great time last time that I couldn't wait to come back.
Oh, I'm so excited. You have been my happy thought all week. And ever since you said last time that you'd be willing to come back again, I've been anticipating this. And I'm so excited to talk about rose. But before we get there, so last time when you talked about nettles, which was and has been one of our most popular episodes ever, you talked about how you got into herbs and told your story. So I recommend that people listen to this episode first and then go check out that episode if you haven't already. So instead of starting in the past, like we did last time, I thought today we could start in the present, and I'd love to hear like what's going on in your herbal life these days, David.
Well, I think for me, I guess one of the significant things is that I just got back from California, and there is a huge trade show. Trade shows are not my idea of a great time, called Expo West, Natural Products Expo West. And I wasn't planning to go this year at all, even though I had been asked to be one of the leaders for the herb walk and everything. But then I got a call from my dear friend, Mark Blumenthal, about a month ago. And it was really funny. He says to me, "Are you coming out to Expo?" And I said, "No, I'm not coming this year." And he goes, "Oh, that's too bad." And I said, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, you know, they give out awards every year." And he says, "We were hoping that you would introduce somebody who's getting an award." And I said, "Really? Who did you want me to introduce?" And he kind of hemmed and hawed and finally said, you're getting the award. So I said, "Well," he says, "Yeah, but you can just send a video and we'll play that when you get the award." But I thought about it. I said, you know, here they are honoring this, you know, and acknowledging the 55 years that I've been learning about and spreading the word about herbal medicine. I just felt that I had to go. So I booked a ticket and flew out to Anaheim. And it was really lovely. You know, I got to see lots of good friends in the herbal community, and there's lots of people there who are outside of the herbal community and the business community, more or less. But it was just lovely to have that. And, you know, not to, it's not like there's a lot of awards or acknowledgments in the herbal world. And so to acknowledge that, and I'll just take a quick tell a quick little story that I said in my quote unquote acceptance speech. And you know, when I first started studying herbal medicine in 1969, there were so few herbalists. It was really lonely. And for a very, very long time, and I was wrong about this, but I thought I was the only herbalist on the East Coast for a long time. I just didn't ever, you know, the only people I knew who were herbalists were all in the West Coast. Nothing, nobody here. There were people, but they were mostly either in, you know, within their own ethnic or rural communities, and they weren't well known outside of those areas. And so, anyway, to me, creating herbal community, which is what that award was about, was really vital because for myself as a young herbalist, number one, I wanted to learn more, and it's hard to learn more in a vacuum. And number two, it was excited. I wanted to share it with people. And it was like no one to share it with. Usually I'd start talking about herbs and people's eyes would glaze over, you know. So to me, it was really exciting. So last year, the New Jersey chapter of the American Herbalist Guild, which is made up almost, I'd say 90 plus percent of former students of mine, decided to do an Herb Day event, which is in May. And they asked me if I'd be, you know, participate and be a keynote speaker. And I said, absolutely, I'd be happy to. So anyway, they work really hard. They put it all together. It was held at a wonderful place called Wellsweep Herb Farm in Port Murray, New Jersey. And, you know, we were kind of hoping a couple hundred people would show up. Over 2,000 people showed up. It is the, as far as we know, it is the single biggest Herb Day event that has taken place anywhere. And as I wandered around this place, you know, filled with former and current students and medical professionals and farmers and kids and, you know, herb enthusiasts and parents and just all these people, I just had this incredible feeling, just like these are my people. And it was so wonderful. And that is the kind of community that I dreamt of all those years ago. And to see it manifest is just amazing. And of course, it's not like our work is done. We have lots more to do. We need to spread the word much further. But to see it go from, you know, an event like that 30 years ago, you might have, you know, if you're lucky, 60 people would have showed up, over 2,000. That was exciting. And so getting the award was exciting. But to me, what's most exciting is that herbs are no longer something that is so far out in left field that when you say to somebody, they say to you, well, you know, what do you do? And you say you're an herbalist. Most people, they look and they go, oh, you like echinacea? You know, I used to get these phone calls from people. They say, what's this herb, echinacea? I don't get those calls anymore. So yes, we have a lot more to do, but it's really exciting to see in, you know, 50 plus years how far we have come to bringing herbs back as to part of mainstream culture rather than something that was, you know, only done in, you know, various ethnic communities or rural communities or by a bunch of us who are hippies back in the late 1960s. That to me is just incredibly exciting.
Yeah, that is. I love both of those stories. Congrats on the award. And yeah, what an incredible Herb Day event. 2,000 people.
Over 2,000.
Yeah.
So
Oh,
we're
really?
doing it again this year.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Wow. That's so wonderful. Well, shall we dive into rose? I know this is a very special plant for you. It's one that I know of, you know, with your very famous grief relief formula. So I think of you with rose as well. Anyway, I'm excited to hear all you have to share about rose, David.
I think I could talk about rose for quite a while. So I think one of the things I said last time when I was on about nettles, one of the things I love about nettles is the fact that from one plant, you get three different medicines. You've got the leaf, which does multiple things. You've got the root, which does different things. And you have the seed, which does still different things. So that to me is wonderful. And roses, similarly, although they are for the most part not a weedy species, except for the multiflora rose here, which are highly invasive, They also provide us with multiple medicines from the same plant. So, of course, most people know about the rose petals, which we will talk about. Of course, we have the rose hips, which, again, most people are aware of. And then even the roots of roses have some activity, although they are certainly not as spectacular, the rose roots, as spectacular as the other parts of the plant. And so I love roses, but when I say I love roses, I'm not talking about those plastic things in the grocery store. I am talking about real roses. And yes, those are living, they were living plants. But when you smell them, most of them, except for the pink ones, still have a vague odor, but all the rest of them, they don't smell like anything. So when I'm talking about roses, I'm talking about fragrant roses. And so whether we are talking about the damask rose, the cabbage rose, the apothecary rose, the beech rose, when it is flowering, if you stick your nose in there, and you actually don't even have to get very close because the fragrant roses are just incredible, you know, a sort of symphony of odor. When you smell them, you know, as long as it is unsprayed and it's, you know, natural unsprayed rose, that rose is going to be amazing medicine. And the medicine doesn't start when you ingest it. The medicine starts when you look at it from afar, and it's gorgeous. I mean, roses, not only do they start blooming here relatively early, but they're one of the last things blooming here in the autumn. I mean, I have roses where, you know, you go out in the morning and they've been frosted, and there's the rose petal with, you know, little bits of ice all around it, and they just don't give up. So for me, roses, number one, the medicine starts in looking at them. They're gorgeous. Then number two, the medicine is inhaling them. And, you know, whether we are doing, you know, a rose essential oil or rose otto or attar of rose, which is really the same thing, whether you're using it in that way or you're just stopping and smelling the roses, you know, that's an old saying, stop and smell the roses. Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, I always stop and smell the roses. But the sad part is probably more than 60, 70% of the time, they have no odor. So if you're going to plant roses, plant the fragrant ones that are a joy and a blessing just to literally be near. And they are incredible. They are so uplifting. And there are dozens of amazing clinical studies on using rose essential oil, both orally, topically, and as aromatherapy, and having a myriad of uses. So we'll talk about the flowers, we'll talk about the rose hips, we'll talk about the roots. And to me, rose is, again, it's just exciting. So when I think about roses, number one, they have been used in medicine for thousands of years. And they are especially important in traditional Persian medicine or traditional Iranian medicine, and i.e. Yunani Tib, which they are in some ways the same, in some ways slightly different. And so they've been used in that tradition forever. They've also have some history of use in Chinese medicine and Ayurveda, but traditional Persian medicine seems to be where they have really reached their pinnacle. And so for me, rose petals, what I like to do with them, and I like to do a lot of things with them. Number one, I like to dry them and use them in teas. I also make tinctures out of them. You can make a tincture out of the fresh petals or the dry petals. Fresh tincturing is a little trickier because you have to account for all the water in there. And fresh rose petals have about 92% water. So you have to kind of account for that to make sure your alcohol percentage in the tincture doesn't drop too low, in which case you can then get, you know, it won't preserve it and you can get mold. You can make rose petal glycerates. You can make rose syrups out of the rose petal. So, I mean, there's just so many ways that you can prepare them. What I will say, though, is that when you ingest them, the really fragrant roses, it's a little bit like ingesting perfume. They can be so perfumey that it's almost like I can't drink it. And so what I will say to people, when you use them as tea, generally speaking, I wouldn't do an entire cup of rose petal tea. I think it really mixes well with a lot of other herbs. And so you use a little bit of rose petals with everything else to make something that tastes absolutely delicious. It really mixes really nicely with your chai herbs, with cinnamon, if you like licorice, so with licorice or fennel or aniseed. And it just is absolutely delightful. And it can be drunk as a calming nervine. So rose petals act as a nervine, which means it's a nerve tonic. It's not sedating, but it is gently calming. And again, we talked about inhaling them. It, you know, acts as an antidepressant. Well, so does ingesting them. And roses for me are a phenomenal antidepressant, especially for people who are depressed and have a broken heart. And so, you know, we hear all the time that that's sort of a, you know, it's not an actual phenomenon, but it is. And in fact, there's even something in medicine called the broken heart syndrome. And many of us, you know, our listeners have seen something like this. You have somebody, I can think of a dear friend of mine who was a naturopathic physician and an amazing herbalist as well. His name was Bill Mitchell. And Bill was vital and brilliant and just one of the most amazing people. And sadly, his son passed away and he died the next day. Mm-hmm. And that's a broken heart. And so the reality is that this is real, whether somebody's been married 50 years and one partner dies and the next one dies within a few months, even though they were relatively healthy, that's a broken heart. And roses are astonishing, not only as a mood elevator, but for broken hearts. And I find them especially useful for people who are sensitive. You know, these are people who are easily affected, you know, by, and I'm not talking about necessarily what, you know, the type of oversensitivity you might see with somebody who, for instance, they get easily affected by, you know, too strong scents or the weather, or I'm talking about people who emotionally are just very sensitive. They tend to be very empathic. They tend to feel other people's pain. They tend to feel very deeply when something happens, whether it is out in the world or within their life. And for those people, I think roses are astonishing. And so, as you mentioned earlier, the grief relief formula, that's a formula that the plants told me. I didn't invent it. The plants told me about the formula. And it's mimosa or albizia bark, along with hawthorn berries and flowers, and organic fragrant rose petals. And I use that formula, again, for broken hearts. I use it for chronic grief. I use it for what I call stagnant depression. And if you look in the DSM-5, which is the Directory of Psychiatric Diseases, there's no category called stagnant depression. And that's because I coined the term. And it's not like I made up the depression. Depression was real, just there was no real term for it. And with stagnant depression, is situational depression, which virtually all of us experience at some time in our lives. Something bad happens and we feel bad. That's normal. But most people, given some time, it could be 6 months, a year and a half. There's no, you know, sort of like 6 months is up, you should get on with your life. But most people, within a certain amount of time, it's not like you forget what happened, but time is one of the great healers. And most people go back to their life. They manage to find their way back into their life. The pain is still there. It's just you're at a greater distance from it and you can function and go on with your life and hopefully find joy and love and happiness. But some people get stuck. Mm-hmm. And that trauma becomes like the sun. And they become like a planet orbiting that event. And they don't have the strength to escape the gravitational pull of that trauma. That is stagnant depression. And it can last not just for months. It can last for decades. It can last for a lifetime. And so, yes, you see there's overlap with PTSD for sure, except that this tends to not be focused so much on reinstatement of fear memories as with PTSD as reinstatement of grief and depression. So that combination is absolutely wonderful. I also use another combination for children who are experiencing intense grief. And that is, I use lemon balm with mimosa flowers, which are nice, but much milder than the bark, and organic rose petals. And that is a lovely formula I use, especially for children who are grieving, who have, you know, had some type of horrible trauma in their life. And sadly, around the world today, we see so many children, both here and abroad, who are suffering unspeakable traumas that no child should ever have to experience. But sadly, they do. You know, I don't use these kinds of things, like, for instance, initially when somebody is experiencing at least normal grief, because actually I believe grief is a normal process and it is a way of pushing us to grow. But at a certain point, most people, and I'm not talking about children now, but most adults feel like they want to move on. They want to move beyond the grief. And for me, that's sort of the time when I use that. I also put in Herbalist and Alchemist, we make a bunch of adaptogen formulas. Gee, why funny that, how that is. In our women's adapt, we have herbs like shatavari, which a lot of people know of as a wonderful tropho restorative to the female reproductive system and a probable adaptogen. We have red ginseng, which a lot of people would say, red ginseng, that's a man's herb. Well, first of all, there's no such thing as men's herbs or women's herbs. They work for all genders, but there's a whole bunch of studies over the last 10 years showing red ginseng has some very significant benefits for women, cardiac benefits, antidepressant benefits, you know, benefits enhancing libido, etc. And one of the other herbs in there is rose petals, even though it is not an adaptogen. Again, I just find that it works so well, again, especially for people who feel deeply. And, you know, there's not like it's not like one gender or the other or whatever feels more deeply than another. But for people who do feel deeply and are easily affected by the difficulties in the world around us, the difficulties in their life, the interpersonal challenges, I just find it to be a wonderful thing. Mm. So those are, you know, just a few of the things about rose petals, sort of on an emotional level, but they work beyond that as well.
Well, I want to hear about that. And I also want to mention the recipes that you have shared with us, because you've brought up one kind of a formula that's part of one, which is the Uplift Tea Blend. And in here you have rose petals, lemon balm, the mimosa flowers, like you mentioned, and then some additional ones like holy basil, orange peel, damiana, and even saffron too. What a beautiful tea blend.
Yeah, that is one I like to give to people who aren't necessarily depressed, although I will say it works pretty nicely for seasonal affective disorder as well. But again, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, I just think that we are living in a time where we are overwhelmed, you know, whether it be social media, whether it be television, whether it be the last 4 years of COVID, you know, all those sorts of things. It's just sometimes life seems too much. And so for people who are just feeling this sense of unease, of feeling like perhaps slight sense of hopelessness, of mild depression, this kind of tea blend is just a lovely thing that you can drink on a daily basis. It just uplifts you. It is profoundly anti-inflammatory. Again, it has a mood elevating qualities. It enhances sleep quality. And I don't know, who do you know that couldn't use that?
I'm already just like, I think I have all these ingredients. I'm going to put that together.
I have a gallon jar that I keep. I make it about usually once a year. And I have a gallon jar, you know, I blend it all up and everything. I try to keep things like rose petals and things like that. I try to keep as whole as possible. I mean, I separate them from the flower, but I try to keep them as whole as possible because they lose those aromatic qualities relatively quickly unless they're stored properly. So I like to keep them, you know, in a dark area that tends to be on the cool side, tightly stoppered. And that way the tea is available anytime I want it. Or if I have company, you know, I make people tea and everybody's like, oh, this is really interesting. I've never tasted anything quite like that before. And it's just a lovely blend.
Yes, it is. And for anyone who wants to download their recipe card for this recipe, you can go to herbswithrosaliepodcast.com. We have a beautifully illustrated recipe card for you. And do you want to talk about your other recipe now? Want to save it?
Remind me.
It's all right. It's rose petal and holy basil infused honey.
Oh, yes. So with this, and I kind of was suggesting that you could sweeten the tea blend that we just talked about with this. This kind of adds to
My
it.
gosh.
And so some people like to take fresh herbs and put them in honey. The problem with that is, at least theoretically, I've never heard of a case of this, but I've read that it's at least theoretically possible that if you happen to have something like botulism and you put it in honey because honey is anaerobic, it could actually grow. So, because of that, just to prevent anything like that, and because I don't really want to cook the honey, what I do is I take dried holy basil. So, I've just dry it, it's freshly dried, and freshly dried rose petals, and basically take a jar and maybe fill the. So let's say the jar is, let's a 16-ounce jar. So maybe I put, this much of the holy basil and rose petals in there, and I grind them up and I just cover it with honey. And then I put it on a warming tray. And I do that usually for a week to 2 weeks. And every day I shake it up a little bit. And after 2 weeks, I strain it out. Now, granted, it takes a little bit of time. And you don't want to use too fine a strainer because it will never go through. Honey's pretty viscous. But what I actually use is a colander. All right. And basically I put a bowl under the colander, I pour it in, I let it slowly drip down until all the herb material, or at least most of it, anything that's left is tiny particles. I don't care about that. And then I put it back into the original jar. And it takes on the odor and chemistry of the roses and the holy basil, and it's delicious, and it gives you additional medicinal benefits. Now, granted, honeys are not going to be as strong as a tincture or even a glycerate, but they still add activity. And again, you get that incredible fragrance and aroma. And don't think that when you're making a cup of tea, now, if you're making a cup of, oh, I don't know, let's say you're making a cup of nettles tea. You can breathe in the steam, but you're not going to smell very much. At most, it smells slightly green. But when you are making tea, especially something that's aromatic, now, yes, it's nice to put it in a teapot or put a cup, a plate on top of the cup so that all those volatile oils don't wind up all over your house. You actually want to ingest them. But what I'll do is when I'm done letting it steep, I take the plate off the cup and I just sit there and I inhale the steam. And it's, again, think of it as primitive aromatherapy. And it is absolutely lovely. And then if you take some of that honey and you stir it in, inhale the steam, because you're going to get all those lovely rose notes and you're going to get the holy basil notes. And I will say, in addition, one other thing. Some years ago, I was teaching in the UK and I trying to remember where I was. I wasn't at Kew Gardens, which I love, by the way. I was up somewhere by Oxford. And there was this amazing herb garden that I was teaching in, and they had these extensive rose gardens. And as I was wandering around, literally from plant to plant, smelling each one, I came across one of the most magnificent smelling roses I have ever smelled in my life. The petals were pink and yellow, kind of combination. And when you smelled it, it smelled like roses with a hint of cinnamon. It was astonishing. And I don't know the name of the breed of roses. So if somebody knows, I'd love to know. But I want to grow these. And I can you imagine doing it with that? Wow, it would be astonishing.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. Well, thank you for both of those recipes. Rose petal honey is hands down my favorite herbal preparation. I make so much of it, I gift it. I also love holy basil honey. I've never combined the two, so I'm doing that this year for sure.
they work really nicely together. Now, of course, there are different varieties of holy basil, and so I actually prefer the holy basil, not the, there's a wild holy basil which I don't generally use. I prefer the one, there's a sort of one that has reddish leaves and one that has green leaves. I actually think the one with green leaves tastes a little nicer. And then I should also just mention to people, a lot of what people think is holy basil in the United States isn't. A lot of it is African basil, which is being sold as temperate Tulsi, but it's lovely and it has some activity as a carminative. But unfortunately, there's no evidence that that has any similarity of activity to holy basil. You know, that would be like saying garden basil is the same as holy basil, which it most certainly is not. So just people need to be aware that if you've got a basil in your garden and you live in a sort of temperate zone and it comes back on its own every year, that's the African basil, the temperate Tulsi, not actual Rama or Vanna Tulsi.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, last year I grew all the varieties. It was very fun to see the differences, taste them, smell them. Yeah.
They're really quite different.
Yeah,
They
they are.
really are.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned about rose petals. You were hinting that there was some more that you had to share about rose petals.
There is. So in traditional Persian medicine, rose petals are also seen as both a liver and cardiac tonic. And in Persian medicine, and one of the cool things, I mean, granted, I'm not super fond politically of the sort of government of Iran. You know, the people there, I think, would like freedom. But one cool thing about Iran, probably because of embargoes, is that they are now the world center for herbal research. They more herbal research is published coming out of Iran than any other country. And when I say herbal research, I'm talking about stuff that's relevant to us as herbalists, meaning they are using teas and tinctures and things like that, rather than a lot of the Chinese studies, which are using, you know, isolated extracts of one chemical from a plant, or they're using herbal extracts as injectables. I'm an herbalist. We don't do that kind of stuff. So it's really relevant research. And there's all this wonderful research out of Iran showing that rose petals are a mild hepatoprotective herb. They can protect against things like acetaminophen toxicity. And so, you know, you go back to Ibn Sina. Americans know him as Avicenna, but his name is Ibn Sina. And he's talking about using roses for helping with, you know, inflammation of the liver, with hepatitis, with hepatomegaly, which is enlarged liver. And so this is the history of using it that way goes way back. He also talks about using it as a cardiac remedy. And this is one of the things that I think is really interesting, because in Chinese medicine, the heart stores Shen. And if you're reading a lot of books, the translation of Shen will be something like spirit. And while that's legitimate, when most Americans hear the word spirit, they're thinking of something like your soul. That's not what is meant by spirit. If you looked at a child who is really full of vigor and alive, you go, that's a spirited child. That is Shen. But Shen is consciousness. Shen is the mind. And so somebody who has disturbed Shen, that would be depression, anxiety, ADHD, OCD behaviors. Those all disturb Shen. And so in Chinese medicine, the heart is both the Western physiological heart, that is a pump that moves our blood, but it also stores Shen. What's really cool about all of this is in the last 30 years in the West, we have come to understand that the heart also has endocrine function. And everything the Chinese say about the heart, we now understand that there, again, we talked about broken heart syndrome. We know about things like stress-induced hypertension, white coat syndrome, where stress affects our blood pressure. Stress can worsen angina. Stress can worsen congestive heart failure. Serious stress can cause heart damage. So this idea that the heart and the mind are separate is a bit of a fallacy. And so I love roses, especially not only for just the sort of psychological phenomenon of a broken heart, but again, as a tonic to the heart, to the blood vessels, to the capillaries. Hearts are hearts. Roses are hearts, maybe too, but roses are full of flavonoids and polyphenols, which are anti-inflammatory and help inhibit atherosclerosis. That tea that we talked about before with the saffron and the lemon balm and the mimosa flowers also inhibits atherosclerosis. It's anti-inflammatory. And so just drinking like that, something like that on a daily basis can have benefits, of far ranging benefits, well beyond, you know, just the psychological benefits of roses. I would also say, in addition to that, it can help heal gastric irritation and loss of intestinal epithelial barrier function, which many of our listeners know of as leaky gut syndrome. It actually can help heal the intestinal epithelial barrier. And we now know that so much illness is related to a loss of epithelial barrier function in the gut. So that, you know, we go back to a healthy intestinal microbiome, a healthy, you know, enteric brain or the gut brain, and epithelial barrier function. When that epithelial barrier is damaged, which can come from liver disease, excessive antibiotic use, gut dysbiosis, COVID, any number of things that can cause that, it allows proteins that are supposed to be excreted to be reabsorbed into the bloodstream. We also know that, for instance, the gut strongly affects the mind, and gut inflammation triggers neuroinflammation, and gut inflammation increases anxiety, increases depression, increases the risk of Alzheimer's. Gut inflammation increases the risk of heart disease. And so these things are all related, and rose petals have a benefit for all of them.
Mm. What an amazing plant, huh? And then it really? You know, smells so pretty too. And then humans are just so attracted to them. I mean, we just can't get enough of them, and you can see why. They have so many benefits on so many different levels.
It's true.
Yeah. And that's just the petals.
Yeah, that's true. And I'll just give you a couple more little things about the petals.
Absolutely.
We talked about the petals helping to relieve gastric inflammation and irritation. That includes gastritis, gastric ulcers, you know, leaky gut. The petals also heal the buccal mucous membranes. So a rose petal tea, all right, as a mouthwash, can help heal things like canker sores, apthostomatitis. It can help with gum disease. They also have has antibacterial activity. And rose petals are interesting in that they have some astringency and a demulcent quality all at the same time. So they're both moistening and drying at the same time. And there are not a lot of herbs that do that. But that means they tonify mucous membranes, but at the same time, they don't dry them out. You can use rose petals as a gargle for sore throats. And one of my favorite gargles for sore throats is rose petals and sage. Just common garden sage and rose petals is phenomenal for sore throats. You can use rose petals. You can make a buffered saline eye wash out of dried organic rose petals and use it as an eye wash for conjunctivitis. You can take a fresh rose petal and just moisten it with a little bit of water. And let's say you have a cut or a scrape or a bug bite, and just stick it on there. As long as you don't have like hairy arms like I do, and stick it right on your skin, it'll dry on your skin and make a bandage.
I love it.
So, time to talk about rose hips.
Rose hips. All right. Thank you, rose petals.
All right. Well, I want to make sure that we give rose hips their due. So, you know, when it comes to rose hips, some of the species that we talked about before, again, the apothecary rose, the cabbage rose, the damask rose, those are known for their flowers. Any rose hip that is big enough can be used. Now, you talk about the multiflora roses, they have these tiny little rose hips. And yeah, if you really wanted to bother, you could gather them, but it's a lot of work for not much rose hip. But the Rosa canina, the dog rose, has a rose hips about, so big. Hopefully you can see that. The beach rose has the biggest rose hip I have ever seen, the wild beach roses. And those are about the size, I don't know. I've seen them as big as that. Mm-hmm. They're pretty large. And so I prefer to gather rose hips that are from the species that have the large hips. You want to gather them when they are fully ripe, which means they are red, not orange, but fully red. Now, one of the misnomers that people have about rose hips is they're really rich in vitamin C. Everybody knows that. The only problem is that's not really true. I mean, they do contain some vitamin C. There's no doubt about that. But you know, when I'll ask a class, I'll say, well, if we had 8 ounces of rosehip powder, so you've taken, ground them up, you haven't lost anything by doing this, so there's all the vitamin C is still there. If you have 8 ounces of the powdered rosehip, how much vitamin C do you think's in there? And people go, 1,000 milligrams, 500 milligrams, 50. So there's some vitamin C, it's true, but 50 milligrams is not a hugely rich amount of vitamin C. Acerola cherries have more, camu berries have much more. But the thing is that the benefit of rose hips isn't just because of vitamin C. It's because of flavonoids. And rose hips are really rich in a whole range of flavonoids and polyphenols, especially what are called OPCs or oligomeric procyanidins. OPCs are also known as PCOs, procyanidin oligomers. For some reason in chemistry, almost everything seems to have at least two names. Not quite sure why that might be, but it seems to be true. So here again, the beach roses, the dog rose in Europe, the cinnamon rose, which isn't the one I was talking about, although maybe it's a cultivar of that one, all have really large rose hips, which are the ones, again, I prefer. So they're rich in flavonoids, and flavonoids are, there's two words we tend to use when we talk about flavonoids. You know, everybody says they are number one antioxidant and number two anti-inflammatory. The problem with both of those terms is that neither one of them means what we think they mean. So, for instance, when we say antioxidant, what do antioxidants do? They quench free radicals. Well, to some degree, that is correct. But the reality is, if antioxidants quench free radicals to the degree that we think they do, they'd actually be in some ways harmful because you need a certain level of these reactive oxygen and nitrogen species to trigger your own natural production of superoxide dismutase and reduced catalase and glutathione in the mitochondria. And it turns out that one of the things that these quote unquote antioxidants are doing is they're actually upregulating genes called the antioxidant responsive element. And when these genes are upregulated, it causes a reduction in inflammation throughout the entire body. So in many ways, they're more antioxidants than they are, excuse me, more anti-inflammatories than they are antioxidants. But then we have the problem with the word anti-inflammatory. And there are anti-inflammatories that are pharmaceuticals, and there are anti-inflammatories that are herbs, and they don't do quite the same thing. The assumption is that they work the same way. But there's a reason that herbal anti-inflammatories don't cause all sorts of problems like so many pharmaceutical anti-inflammatories do, to the point where many of them they have to be taken off the market because of the damage. We need a certain level of inflammation in our bodies for our bodies to function. If you totally shut down that process, it becomes problematic. And the cool thing about herbal anti-inflammatories is they shut down part of the process, not the whole process. So they don't cause the secondary problems that many pharmaceutical anti-inflammatories do. So rose hips are, well, I'll use air quotes, anti-inflammatory and antioxidant. There are numerous human clinical trials showing rose hips, and this can be taken as a tea, they can be taken as a syrup, they can be taken ground up in powder and put into capsules, have systemic anti-inflammatory effects, which helps with everything from osteoarthritis, human studies showing it basically downregulated inflammation and pain in people with rheumatoid arthritis. People with back pain. We talked about before the rose petals being useful for helping to inhibit atherosclerosis. Rose hips can do that as well. And so they have this systemic anti-inflammatory, antioxidant effect that basically what we know is that virtually every disease that we are heir to as we age, hypertension, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, cancer, arthritis, autoimmune diseases, Alzheimer's, et cetera, are all inflammatory-mediated disease, inflammation-mediated diseases. So if you take rose hips, for instance, on a daily basis, or you take hibiscus on a daily basis, or you take, I don't know, blueberries or whatever, it doesn't mean you're not going to get these things. But what it does mean is you reduce your chance that you'll get these things. I mean, there's some things between genetics and the environment we live in, or if you happen to be a smoker or any number of other things, you know, unhealthy habits that certainly increase your risk. But anything that you can do on a daily basis, and by the way, you don't need to do the same one. Today it could be, you know, blueberries. Tomorrow it could be raspberries. The next day it could be rose hips or green tea, you know, spices like rosemary and sage and thyme. But the idea is the more you use these things in your diet on a regular basis, it reduces the risk of all of those diseases. Again, it's not a guarantee. It doesn't mean you won't ever get them, but it reduces the risk. And if you do get them, it may also reduce the severity of them as well. So we really want to encourage people to consume these things, when, again, whether it's rose hips or any of these other things, on a regular basis. Rose hips also, in Chinese medicine, do something else that's kind of interesting. They astringe a leaky jing gate. Now, you know what they say? It don't mean a thing if you don't got the jing. In Chinese medicine, jing is the life force. And jing is stored in the kidney. And in men, a leaky jing gate is associated with either premature ejaculation or urinary dribbling that occurs usually with benign prostatic hyperplasia as men age. In women, a leaky jing gate is associated with frequent urination or a heavy non-specific vaginal discharge that they can't culture anything. It's just this, you know. And by the way, you have sort of a two jing gates, but it would also, like, fecal incontinence would be a leaky jing gate. So, you know, you don't want to be jing free. You need your life force, your energy. And rose hips are used to astringe a leaky jing gate, which means they can be used for urinary frequency, urinary dribbling, benign prostatic hyperplasia in men. I mean, they just are wonderful. And studies have also shown that regular consumption of rose hips as a tea helps prevent UTIs. Because one of the things is it does is it acidifies the urine. And alkaline urine, and interestingly enough, women tend to have more alkaline urine than men, and vegetarians and vegans have more alkaline urine. A alkaline urine, you're more likely to get E. coli infections, which is the most common cause of UTIs. So simply, and you know, everybody knows about cranberry, but the reality is rose hips have a similar effect in basically acidifying the urine and helping to prevent urinary tract infections. So it, you know, rose hips are, again, remarkable. Now, not everybody loves the sourness of rose hips. I prefer sour to sweet. I love, you know, when I was a little kid, I used to like eating lemons until my uncle, who was my dentist, told me my teeth were going to be destroyed. So I stopped doing that. But I've always enjoyed, you know, I love hibiscus tea. I like rose hips tea, things like that. So if you're not a huge fan of that sour flavor, it again combines with other things really well, depending on your flavor profiles. And so, for instance, if you had somebody who had sort of chronic UTIs, you could mix those rose hips with something like nettle leaf. You could mix that with something like, if there's urinary irritation, a little bit of marshmallow, something like that, which would reduce that sourness and still be a useful substance for helping to prevent those kinds of problems. Lastly, I would also mention that rose hips, they're not strongly astringent because of all that sourness, and that's all those fruit acids and the polyphenols. It also is really useful for things like mild diarrhea or people who just have poorly formed stools. It can be really useful there as well. So, I mean, rose hips are just astonishing.
They are. They're some of my favorite. And like you said, there's so many different ways to enjoy them. I've taken the powder and baked it into baked goods.
How did that work? I've never tried that.
It works really great. Yeah, I had to experiment with it a bit, you know, to get the right proportions. But I can send you a recipe of a rose hip spice cake that I came up with.
Ooh.
It's delicious. And I love I know that you don't like the fresh herbs and honey. And I get that. I still do it though. And I love fresh rose hips in honey. You have to take the seeds out, but it's quite delicious. And I'm with you on those big rose hips too. My local native rose hips are just so tiny that it's not worth it. But when you find the big plum size ones, oh, it's so good. Yeah.
Let me just add one thing to that. For when people are going to do rose hips, because the seeds, there is actually oil in those seeds that is really wonderful moisturizing oil, but you can't extract it. It's chemically extracted. It can't be extracted by pressing it. So we're not going to go there. But when you take the seeds out, inside are these tiny little hairs. And when you, if you're going to cut them, and I usually do is I cut them in half with a knife and then use a spoon to scoop out the seeds and little hairs. I'm just going to warn y'all, wear gloves, wear a mask, and wear goggles. Because if those little hairs get into your cornea, it'll ulcerate. If they get up your nose or in your mouth, it will ulcerate. If they get in your hands, everywhere those little hairs get in, you'll develop sores. It's not pleasant. So I will say that if you buy rose hips where they've already dehulled them and taken the seeds out, it's a lot easier.
I often talk about that, like my lazy herbalist ways. I love those, getting them cut like that. And those are so fun to rehydrate. You just rehydrate those and you can eat them by the bushel, really. So thank you so much for mentioning about the irritating hairs. That is very important.
I learned the hard way.
Oh, that sounds like it. Speaking from experience.
So let me just finish up by just mentioning that if you do happen to have the Floribunda rose, which is a horrible weedy plant, unfortunately. I mean, it's super aggressive. It's really thorny, tiny, tiny little rose hips. The flowers are tiny. It was originally brought into the U.S. as what they called a living fence or a living hedge. Well, it worked, except that it takes over, especially in woodlands and fields, and chokes out everything else. When you take those plants, if you're weeding them, pull them out by the roots and then cut the roots off, wash them, cut them into pieces and dry them. And rose roots, this is from any rose, but I wouldn't dig up a rose that I wanted. But these weedy roses, dig them up, use the roots, and it basically is a good, moderate acting astringent. And so I don't use astringents a lot, but again, topically for a cut or a scrape as part of a formula for something like diarrhea, you know, short-term use, they can be useful. So even that weedy rose, there's something positive you can get out of it, and that would be the root.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much about rose. I know people have been busily scribbling down notes because that was just so much. And I love just your love of rose shines through, David. It really comes through. Well, I'm really excited to talk about your next enrollment for your course, and I want to hear about it. I have questions already on my brain, but I will let you just begin with, you know, for people who are like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I would love to study more with David. How do they do that?
Well, my program is called the David Winston Center for Herbal Studies, and the basic program is a 2-year program. It meets weekly, one evening a week for 2 years. There's a few weeks off here and there scattered throughout the 2 years. And this upcoming program will be the 45th and 46th year of the 2-year program. And we have had thousands of students go through the program. I'd say about half of my students are already medical professionals. We get physicians, veterinarians, nurse practitioners, nurses, pharmacists, nutritionists, dentists, chiropractors, acupuncturists, et cetera. And the other half of my students are people who have been self-studying herbal medicine on their own usually, or maybe they've taken multiple classes here or there, whether introductory classes. And over the last 15 years, I've started getting people who are really high-level clinical herbalists who are my colleagues taking my program. And I'm like, this is not designed. But we focus in on things that are not often taught in many other programs. One of those is something you do as well, and that's energetics. Understanding energetics, not just from a TCM model or an Ayurvedic model, but from a Western model of how to understand energetics so that you can take herbs and create a formula that is like a tailored suit of clothing that fits the person you are treating. So this gives you the ability to stop treating diseases and treat people. And I guarantee you the results you're going to get when you treat a specific person is way better than the results you get if you are treating generic depression. So that's what we do. And it's a wonderful program. There are several other teachers, including myself. And we have 2 1-year programs, which meet monthly for people who are graduates of the 2-year program, the graduate program and the therapeutics program, for people who really want to become clinicians and take it to that next level. But this program is designed to be a basic education for somebody who is moving in the direction of becoming a clinical herbalist. It's, you know, if somebody wants to be an herb grower, that's great, but this is not the program for them. Yes, we talk about there are classes on medicine making, but the focus isn't medicine making. But we certainly want you to know how to make a tincture, et cetera. If you're interested in folklore and things like that, that's fantastic, but we don't do a lot of that. This is really, the focus is clinical herbal medicine, differential diagnosis, energetics, and materia medica, materia medica, materia medica. And
I love
the allopaths back in the 1800s used to say the eclectics were materia medica mad. Well, I materia medica mad. We teach almost 300 plants in exquisite detail. And, you know, some people say, well, why do you need to know so many plants? Well, to give you an example, if you have somebody who comes to you and says they are having a headache and it feels like somebody's stabbing them with an ice pick, as soon as I hear those words, I know what herb that person needs, at least one of them, and it's called sweet melilot, Melilotus alba or Melilotus officinalis. And it is the specific indications, the eclectic specific indications, are pain that is sharp and stabbing. And I'd combine that probably with some St. John's wort, maybe some Ligusticum chuancheong, the Chinese herb. If the pain is peripheral, hands and feet, prickly ash. And so the idea is you get to know these plants on a level that goes beyond what's in most books. And it helps you to really start looking at, again, how to treat the person. So you can have 10 people diagnosed with depression. They're not 10 depressions. They are 10 unique people. There is GI-based depression, hepatic depression, blood sugar-induced dysregulation-induced depression, old age depression, inflammation-induced depression, cardiac depression, thyroid-induced depression, and the list keeps going on. And if you just try to treat it as a single entity, which unfortunately orthodox medicine tends to do, and you give somebody an SSRI or an SNRI, when you look at the clinical studies, what percentage of people actually respond to those medicines? And the answer is about 40%. Mm-hmm. 33% respond to placebo. So that means those medications are about 7% more effective than placebo. Although, if you add in some of the unpublished studies that a guy got a hold of a few years ago, they actually don't perform all that much better than placebo. So if somebody's taking those medicines and it works for them, that's fantastic. Keep doing it. But if you're one of those people that's taking those medicines, those medications, and it didn't work for you, part of the problem might be is that they don't touch what's going on for you. If you have somebody, again, with a thyroid-induced depression or a cardiac-induced depression or GI-induced depression, unless you deal with that underlying issue, which is leaky gut or GI inflammation or hypothyroidism or, you know, a heart damage, your depression is not actually going to get better. Mm-hmm. So that's our focus.
Yeah. So this sounds so exciting. Do people have to move to New Jersey in order to
attend? No. The class is online. And so we have students all over the world. For the first, as I said, this will be the 45th and 46th year. For the first, I don't know, 20 years, it was in person. And I had people driving for a 5-hour class. I had people driving to New Jersey because I was in New Jersey then. I'm in Pennsylvania now. But I had people driving from West Virginia, Virginia, Massachusetts. We're talking about 4 to 6 hour drives to take a 5-hour class. I thought they were crazy, but they thought it was worth it. But now it's online. There are a few live classes that we do, mostly herb walks and things like that. And if somebody wants to come for those, they're welcome to do so, but they're also recorded. And the beauty of it is that all of it's recorded. So, you know, let's say you're in your second year and you think, you know what? I still don't feel like I really got that TCM module. You can go back and watch it. And so it really is quite wonderful. And then we have quarterly meet and greets where students come on and, we just talk and it's much more social. And it's just a wonderful community. And we try to match students up. So if there are other people in their area, we had one group who were in Chicago, they were all in Chicago, and they would get together every week and do class together, and then had their own study group and everything. It's just wonderful. It's this amazing community of people.
I love that, David. And I think clinical training is just so important. I did my own clinical training and I was a clinician for a while. And even though I'm not anymore, I'm so grateful for it because, like you said, you can have so many different interests in herbalism. There's something about the clinical herbalism where it's like the rubber meets the road. Like it's no longer theoretical. It's not like, oh, lemon balm is good for digestion. You really learn how to work with plants, how to formulate them, how to dose them, how to work with people, how to figure out when things go wrong, all of that. And it just takes that like theoretical into super practical where you really get to work with the plants and see how amazing they are. Yeah.
True.
Well, we will put all of the information about how to sign up for the program in the show notes. What is the time frame for this? I know you're interviewing or you're accepting applications and then you'll enroll. So what's the time frame?
Well, I started interviewing 2 weeks ago. I'll be interviewing probably through August. We only take a certain number of students. And it's funny, people say to me, "Well, what are you looking for in a student?" And what I tell people is there's four things that I really think are important to me. Number one, that the person is passionate about herbs, herbal medicine, and/or healthcare. That's number one. Number two, I look for people who understand the meaning of the word commitment because it's a 2-year commitment. And if somebody takes a seat, once we start, we can't replace them. And I guarantee you, there was at least several people who wanted to be in the class who might not have gotten in. Number three, I look for people who have a good background. But what does that mean? We have all sorts of students. So we'll have medical doctors who know way more about medicine than I'll ever know, but know very little about herbal medicine. We have other people, as I said before, we have people who are world-class herbalists taking this class who are phenomenal. But the reality is, I don't care how much you know. And this is for everybody, myself included. No matter how much you know, it is a fraction what there is to know. I am so grateful. I learn from my students all the time. Hopefully, they're learning more from me, but sometimes I'm not sure about that. And the fourth thing I'm looking for is people who are open-minded. And the reason for that is that if you've already decided what is true and what you believe, there's not a lot of room for new things. And so I want people who are willing to consider, and I always tell my students, I say, listen, keep an open mind. Consider that everything you know is subject to change. It doesn't mean it will. Some things you'll just get more sure of as you go along because you'll just see it over and over again. But other things, sometimes, we've been taught something. I remember I redid my paper on migraines about 5 years ago, and I redo all my classes and papers about every 2 years. So about 5 or 6 years ago, and I was redoing the class, and of course, in order to redo it, you have to look what's the new research. And the new research was suggesting that the model that I had been taught and that every medical doctor had been taught and probably every herbalist had been taught for decades of how migraines occur was wrong. Now, I could have sat there and said, no, but this has got to, this is right. But what it did is allowed me to, open my mind and say, oh, this is totally different than what I was taught. And what we find out is that it explained why sometimes the treatment protocols didn't work. And now that we are using this new model, I see that the results that we get are superior than what we used to get before. So keeping an open mind, and there are no sacred cows. Yes, some people believe in this or believe in that. Fine. I don't argue with success, but keep an open mind because that means you're still open to the possibility of learning. And hopefully, each and every one of us will be learning till our last breath.
Oh, I love all of those, especially the last one just seems like a great thing for us all to aspire to. Well, again, we will put all the information on how to get more information and to sign up in the show notes. We'll make it easy for you to find there. And David, you've been so generous with your time. I'm so appreciative. And before you go, I have one last question for you. And that question is, how do herbs instill hope in you?
Well, As I alluded to earlier, the world we're living in right now, and I'm old enough to remember. I'm sure we have listeners who don't remember this. When I was a little kid, we used to have nuclear bomb drills in school. We used to have to go under our desks and tuck our head between our legs, like that was going to protect us if somebody dropped a nuclear bomb. And it was pretty stressful. I mean, we were little kids. What did we know? But it was definitely scary. Well, we're not doing that anymore. But if we look around the world we live in, it is a pretty challenging place. There's a lot going on, whether we are talking about the environment, whether we are talking about politics, whether we are talking about social justice, whether we are talking about poverty, in the list of war, et cetera, the list of the injustices and the traumas and the difficulties is long. And so I can see, and I've talked to a lot of people, especially younger people, who feel, in a sense, like, I don't want to have kids. I don't want to bring children into a world that is so, difficult and where things seem so dire. And for me, this time of year, and I find it interesting because it kind of goes along with Easter. I'm not Christian, but that whole Easter aspect of renewal. This time of year for me as an herbalist is about renewal. 2, 3 weeks ago, the hellebore started blooming. Then the crocuses started blooming. Now my magnolias are blooming. The forsythias are blooming. The corn speedwell is blooming. The world is coming alive again. Our mother, the earth, is coming alive again after a long sleep. And I think of all these plants and trees as my friends. I have these incredible relationships with them that I've, had for, 50 plus years. And for me, it's a joyous time, but it is also an uplifting time. It's a time when I look at these plants and I think, they haven't given up. They're still going to grow. They're still going to bloom. They're still bringing beauty into the world. They are still creating healing medicines for us, for the animals. They are still taking carbon dioxide and turn and creating oxygen for us to breathe. And I use them as a model. There is a keynote talk that I've done several times that I call Lessons the Plants Have Taught Me. And one of the things that the plants have taught me is a sense of perseverance, tenacity, hope, renewal. And these are all things that I learned from different sources, but certainly from the plants themselves, because they are wonderful teachers. They help to show us there is a way to be in the world. And the beauty of it is that with all the challenges, I actually think that if we embrace herbal medicine, first off, the reality is orthodox medicine in the West is absolutely unsustainable. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, yet when it comes to life expectancy, infant mortality, and all sorts of other rankings, we are far below almost every other, developed country. And in many cases, countries that are considered, undeveloped have better statistics than we do. So number one, I think herbal medicine, if we truly embrace it, we're not replacing if you need an appendectomy or if you need brain surgery. Herbs can't do that. But the reality is, if somebody has a UTI, don't give them an antibiotic. Use herbs first. Not only is there a much less impact environmentally by using herbs, especially if they're organically grown, than using a pharmaceutical, which in many cases requires, tremendous amounts of technology and energy and petrochemicals and things like that. But I think it could help create a sustainable practice of medicine, not only here in the US, but around the world, where we use the best of both. But I also think that healthier people, people who are healthy, not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually, hopefully will make better decisions. And if you develop a relationship with these plants and realize how special they are, and that we are so dependent on them, they're not, for the most part, very dependent on us, except maybe like domesticated corn, but we are dependent upon them. And so if we develop an appreciation for these plants and recognize how sacred they are, how special they are, how giving they are of their healing gifts, then maybe we'll start to not only respect them, but respect this planet that they grow on and need to survive, that ultimately we need to survive. And so I still have hope that we can create a better world for us all.
Thank you so much, David. It's been truly an honor to have you back. You can come back anytime. I've absolutely loved this, and I'm just deeply appreciative. And thank you for those beautiful words, too.
Oh, you're so welcome, Rosalie. It is such a pleasure. And it's true, I do know a word, another herb or two.
Okay. You heard it here, everybody. He's coming back. Thanks again, David.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks for being here. Don't forget to head over to the show notes at herbswithrosaliepodcast.com to download your beautifully illustrated recipe card and to get a transcript of this show. There, you'll also be able to sign up for my weekly newsletter, which is the best way to stay in touch with me. You can learn more about David's 2-year herbal program by visiting the show notes for details. You can also purchase herbal supplements from Herbalist and Alchemist at herbalist-alchemist.com. If you'd like more herbal episodes to come your way, then one of the best ways to support this podcast is by subscribing on YouTube or your favorite podcast app. I also love to see your comments, whether they're on the YouTube channel, on the Herbs with Rosalie podcast.com show notes page, or if you simply hit reply to my Wednesday email. I read every comment that comes in, and I share especially nice ones with our guests. I look forward to hearing your herbal thoughts on this interview and Rose. I deeply believe that this world needs more herbalists and plant-centered folks, and I'm so glad that you're here as part of this herbal community. Also, a big round of thanks to the people all over the world who make this podcast happen week to week. Nicole Paul is the project manager who oversees the whole operation from guest outreach to writing show notes to actually uploading each episode and so many other things I don't even know. She really holds this whole thing together. Francesca is our fabulous video and audio editor. She not only makes listening more pleasant, she also adds beauty to the YouTube videos with plant images and video overlays. Tatiana Rusikova is the botanical illustrator who creates gorgeous plant and recipe illustrations for us. I love them. I know that you do too. Christy edits the recipe cards, and then Jenny creates them as well as the thumbnail images for YouTube. Michelle is the tech wizard behind the scenes, and Karen is our student services coordinator and customer support. For those of you who like to read along, Jennifer is who creates the transcripts each week. Xavier, my handsome French husband, is the cameraman and website IT guy. Thanks to Rising Appalachia for their beautiful song, Resilience. Find more of their music at risingappalachia.com. It takes an herbal village to make it all happen, including you. Okay, you've lasted to the very end of the show, which means you get a gold star and this herbal tidbit. You know, in interviewing David this time and last time, I realized, you know, I've really studied a lot with him over the years, but mainly through one-off classes, like through conferences, that sort of thing. I really love the way he teaches. It's like this fire hose of important knowledge that's just firmly rooted in his love of the plants. As I mentioned in this episode, I've already done many years of clinical training, both like a 4-year school and then post training with a mentor, and I loved it all. And even still, now I'm seriously considering David's program as well. So I haven't made a firm decision yet. I'm making no promises, but it's been really fun to think about, and I'm really excited about the idea of it. So if you're feeling called to be a clinical herbalist, or you really want in-depth knowledge about how to work with plants and people, then I know David's course will be amazing. And who knows, I might see you there. Again, information about the course can be found in the show notes. Have a beautiful day.